Hello and welcome to our micronutrient presentation on the mineral potassium. We're going to go into the ups and the downs and the whereabouts of potassium, and it's a really critical electrolyte in our system. We're going to look at why that is and what that is and its relationship to some of the other electrolytes. So before we begin, let's just make sure that you're aware that this presentation is not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional. It's not medical advice. It's intended as a sharing of my knowledge and information and research with you. And I encourage you to make your own healthcare decisions based upon your research and in partnership with a qualified healthcare professional. The information is here just as education. There's no guarantees. There's no implied, hey, benefit of it. It's just really me presenting the science, presenting the research so that you can make your own decision. And then when you're presenting this to your own clients, that you make sure that they're aware of the same situation, that you're not giving them medical advice. So let's look at potassium. Potassium is an essential, it's a macro mineral, meaning we need it in large quantities. It's considered an electrolyte, and it's a major intracellular cation. So it's positively charged, and it's inside the cell, versus sodium, which is positively charged, and it's outside the cell. So they're trying to maintain a balance between the charges on the inside and the outside. So about 95 to 98% of all the potassium lives within the cells, versus what did I say, about 90% of the sodium lives outside of the cells. And it contributes to the maintenance of the concentration and charge differences across the cell membrane. Remember the sodium-potassium ATPase pump, and we'll review that here as well. And I want to review electrolytes. So potassium is an electrolyte, and it's an intracellular cation. And as an electrolyte, it's a salt or ion that's electrically charged, and it moves either in a positive direction or a negative. So the cathode is negative, so cations move towards the cathodes because they're positive and opposites attract. And the positive is the anode, and the anions move towards that because they're negative. So let's look at some of the functions of potassium, and some of the functions are very similar to that of sodium: maintaining blood pH, maintaining electrolyte balance, and controlling water balance along with sodium. It has influences on contractility of muscle, and that's all kinds of muscle, whether it's smooth muscle, skeletal muscle, cardiac muscle. And it affects the excitability of the nerve tissue. Remember, we talked about membrane potentials. It has to do with that. Potassium has been found to help prevent stroke and maintain stable blood sugar. And I'm going to share with you what the criteria are for being able to say that that happens. So let's look at some other potassium functions. Hormones, it's involved in the secretion and the action of certain hormones, especially the blood glucose hormones. Vascular tone, maintaining the integrity, but more the muscular tone of the blood vessels. Gastrointestinal motility, which is super important. So people with SIBO tend to have low gastrointestinal motility. People with constipation tend to have low gastrointestinal motility, and potassium can be helpful in that function. It's important in the metabolism of glucose and insulin, in other words, in getting the sugars into the cells. It's called a mineralocorticoid, which means it's produced, or it's similar in action to the aldosterone, which is produced from the adrenals. It's got the ability to be concentrated by the kidneys, renal, so it's renal concentration. It's involved in the activity of pyruvate kinase, which is an important enzyme in carbohydrate metabolism. And together with magnesium and potassium, it can help prevent calcium oxalate stones. So it helps to bind on to the oxalates and pull them out of the body. So let's look at potassium and blood pressure. Diets high in potassium have been shown to help lower blood pressure. And the FDA has approved you saying this as long as the following criteria are met. So diets containing foods that are good sources of potassium and low in sodium reduce the risk of high blood pressure and stroke. You're allowed to say that to a client without getting in trouble. But that food must contain 350 milligrams of potassium, or about 10% of the daily value. It needs to have less than a gram of saturated fat and greater than 20 milligrams of cholesterol, and less than or equal to 15% of calories from saturated fat. So there's some pretty stringent criteria. If these things hold true, then you're allowed to say that diets high in foods that are good sources of potassium and low in sodium reduce the risk of high blood pressure and stroke. And I'm going to show you a bunch of studies where they've put this to the test and found it to be very effective. Let's look at the membrane potential again. We looked at this when we looked at sodium. You maintain the cell's membrane potential via the sodium-potassium ATPase pumps. The ATPase pumps the sodium out of the cell into the extracellular space and pumps the potassium into the cell. About 20 to 40% of the resting energy expenditure in a typical adult is spent on maintaining this pump, which is pretty amazing considering how many functions there are in the body. For any one function to get 20 to 40% of the energy expenditure says this is a critical, super important function. And we need to have tight control of the membrane potential because nerve impulse transmission relies on the membrane potential, polarizing and depolarizing cell membranes. Muscular contraction relies on the cell membrane potential. Cardiac function relies on having good control at the cell membrane. Stomach function, and then nerve function. So all of these things have important roles to play when it comes to the membrane. And that's, again, what it looks like, just to reiterate. It looks like a big green kidney bean, and the sodium gets put into little spots that are shaped exactly right. The potassium goes into the shapes that are shaped right for it. It closes, and when it opens up on the inside, it lets the sodium go in and it pulls some more potassium out. And that's basically it. And it's an ATPase pump because it requires the energy in order to do this process. So let's take a look at some studies. I've given you links to a bunch of studies. I just wanted to point some of this out because, you know, everybody's looking for, you know, magic bullets, magic pills, right? And some kind of magic medication to help people who are having strokes and cardiovascular disease and hypertension. When in reality, they don't need to look all that far because it's in the food. It's very cool. So there was a study here that took 43,000 men and followed them for 8 years. And those men that were in the top one-fifth of the for potassium intake, meaning they had the highest amount, approximately 4,300 milligrams a day. So those with the highest intake of potassium had the less likely ability to have a stroke. And that's from a study. I'll show you the next page so you know where these numbers are coming from. So these are the studies that these are related to if you want to read them in more detail. These are studies done on lots of people. They studied 9,000 people for an average of 16 years. And the potassium intake was inversely related to stroke in black men and in men with hypertension in particular. Another study looked at potassium intakes higher than 1,352 milligrams a day. There was 72% as likely, so there was a reduced likelihood of having a stroke with potassium intakes lower than 1,352. So people who had the lower potassium intakes had more of a chance of having a stroke by a significant amount. There were 5,600 men and women older than 65, and low potassium intake was associated with a significant increased risk of stroke. And in 26,000 male smokers, they did a study, and the higher potassium intake reduced their risk of stroke. And this isn't somebody who's pretty well destined, determined to have a problem. What they're finding is that the modest intake in fruits and vegetable intake, a modest increase, significantly reduces the risk of stroke. So this is good news, especially if you have someone who's already had a stroke or had a premature stroke or has family members with stroke and they're starting to get up there in their age and they're concerned. It's great news for them. And there's your references. There's six different articles that you can look up, and you can look these up in Medline. Look at potassium and osteoporosis. We don't usually think about potassium and osteoporosis when we're thinking about what is it that person needs. You know, you're thinking calcium and magnesium and boron and things like that. So there was four cross-study sectional studies that looked at the bone mineral density, the DMB, and there was a significant positive association between the potassium intake and the bone density. They had the people do an average of 3,000 to 4,000 milligrams of potassium every day, and the highest intakes were greater than 6,000. The lowest intakes were from 1,400 to 16. Yeah, let's look at this other study, which was 266 elderly women. The highest quartile of potassium excretion had a higher bone mineral density after 5 years compared to the lowest. So clearly, taking in more potassium-rich foods are going to help in buffering the body. When the body is buffered, it doesn't go into such an acidic state. And it's when it's in an acidic state that it starts to steal some of those minerals, the bone-forming minerals, from the bloodstream. So the potassium keeps them in an alkaline state as well as providing some basis. And then short-term supplementation, this was less than 3 months, so it had a significant improvement of potassium citrate. There was decreased urinary acid excretion and biomarkers of bone resorption in postmenopausal women, and it ameliorated the effect of eating a high-salt diet, how that would have on bone metabolism. So here's six studies, and let's look at potassium and high blood pressure. But this is the conclusion of these studies. You can lower blood pressure by increasing potassium via a diet rich in fruits and vegetables and supplemental potassium. This is another study. 17,000 adults in Third National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, NHANES. The higher potassium intake was associated with lower blood pressure. This is 17,000 people in this study. And that's the conclusion they came to. So why is it that so many people are put on blood pressure medications that are very expensive and have a lot of side effects instead of being put on potassium supplements or getting them to eat a diet rich in potassium? Kind of weird, hey? Then there was a DASH study, the dietary approaches to stop hypertension, which showed the beneficial effects of potassium-rich diet on blood pressure. They were having 8.5 servings per day of fruit and vegetables. And that's 4,100 milligrams of potassium. Of the 2,600 that supplemented with potassium chloride, and 2,300 to 3,900 per day. So all of these, both of these cases had very beneficial effects. And the links to those articles for the details are right there. So how well is potassium absorbed? The absorption mechanism is not as clearly understood as the mechanism of absorption for sodium, but it is known that over 90% is absorbed. So like sodium, it's very well absorbed. What is excreted through the kidneys and regulated by aldosterone, which accelerates excretion. With the potassium, it's not so much that it's absorbed in one place over another. It's basically absorbed in both the large and the small intestine, and it's absorbed once it's inside the epithelial cells lining the gut. It's absorbed across the brush border by the potassium hydrogen ATPase pump. So not the potassium sodium, but the potassium hydrogen. It's similar, but it's just using hydrogen ions. So this is a little summary of the various nutrients, the potassium, the chloride, and the sodium, along with the bicarbonate. And it's basically where they're absorbed best and if there's any things that you need to be aware of. So that's a good chart, a good reference chart. I'd probably print that out and keep it handy. With potassium storage, very little of it is actually stored. And when it is, it's stored mainly in the tissues, especially bones. So very little of it's stored. Most of it is kept active and then it's excreted via the urine. What interacts with potassium? Well, calcium, and it's the opposite of the way sodium interacts with it. Excess potassium can actually decrease the urinary loss of calcium. So more potassium helps you to hold on to the calcium. Excess sodium increases potassium excretion. So even if you're not sweating up a storm, there's interactions between the sodium and the potassium. And then magnesium, depletion of magnesium causes low potassium. So these are good things to know because if and chances are your client is on other nutrients. So let's look at some causes of potassium deficiency. The big one is usually diuretics, especially the potassium wasting ones, thiazide, diuretics, and furosemide. Alcoholism. Alcoholism depletes just about every nutrient there is, so it definitely has an effect on creating a problem for potassium. Alcohol actually causes you to pee a lot more than you would for the volume that you're drinking, so it has an effect on the antidiuretic hormone. Vomiting, diarrhea, things like inflammatory bowel disease like Crohn's, anything that's going to cause diarrhea or vomiting is going to cause potassium deficiency. Potassium deficiency is known as hypokalemia, not calcemia, but kalemia. Overuse or abuse of laxatives, somebody's trying to just get themselves going and they start using a lot of laxatives and you're actually pooping away all your good nutrients. So let me just step back to the overuse of laxatives. So anytime somebody is either using a diuretic, which is causing them to pee more, or a laxative that's causing them to poop more, or they're losing their stuff through one of their orifices, that can deplete potassium. Anorexia or bulimia, so food and eating disorders can be a depletion in potassium. And we see that a lot as a risk factor when folks are being scared of eating and doing things. So it's a real problem, both from a physiologic standpoint and from an emotional standpoint. Congestive heart failure can deplete potassium, as well as excess licorice consumption, because licorice has an effect on the aldosterone, and licorice can cause an increase in blood pressure. We use it for people who have very low blood pressure or people who have adrenal fatigue, but we found out that it's very easy to overdo it, and overdoing it for long periods of time can cause you to retain sodium and excrete potassium. I mean, it's not just having a little bit of licorice here or there, having a licorice tea, but it's consistent, especially when you're doing it therapeutically for the adrenals. You can get in trouble. What does potassium deficiency look like? Well, like I said, it's hypokalemia is what it's called. Things like dry skin, acne, chills, protein in the urine, that's proteinuria, constipation, depression, diarrhea, edema, nervousness, insatiable thirst. Again, these can look similar to a sodium issue, insatiable thirst especially, salt retention, heartbeat irregularities, glucose intolerance, growth impairment, high blood cholesterol levels, low blood pressure, muscular fatigue and weakness, nausea and vomiting, periodic headaches, respiratory distress, cognitive impairment, diminished reflux. You know what a lot of people say when I start spewing off all these different deficiency signs, they get a little nervous about how do you differentiate. And that's an art that you'll be getting better and better at the more you learn about the various nutrients and body parts and start to put the picture together. But it's definitely normal for it to feel a little overwhelming. You're like, well, there's a lot of things that can cause diarrhea. How do I know it's low potassium? Again, it's putting together the whole clue, the whole puzzle. Okay, what other things were happening around it and what other symptoms and signs. And I highly recommend you to pull out these charts that I have of the deficiency and excesses for the various nutrients and get them set up in a book at home so that you can refer to them and read them. Adequate intake. Well, the adequate intake goes up dramatically as people age. It goes from 400 in a newborn infant to 700 in the second 6 months. But look where it gets to in adults. It goes all the way up to 4,700. That's a lot. It's a big difference. And even breastfeeding, it's 5,100. It's easy to become deficient if you're not watching, especially, like I said earlier, if you're cutting back on a lot of those foods, the low glycemic foods, because they tend to have a lot of potassium. What about symptoms of excessive potassium? Yes, it does. It's kind of like too little sodium and too much potassium are the rarer things, but they are possibilities and can be very, very serious and even fatal. Because excess potassium would not be taken in generally from food. Nobody can eat that much food. Usually it would be taken by overdoing the supplementation. It can cause cardiac arrhythmia, a heartbeat that's irregular. It can cause cardiac arrest, right? That's like a heart attack or the heart just stops. And it's just not possible to have that happen with diet alone. It's just not. So what causes excessive potassium? Acute kidney failure or chronic kidney disease. So the kidney is not excreting it properly. It's retaining it. Adrenal failure, also called Addison's disease. And my guess is that you can get it excessive as well in like a stage 3 adrenal fatigue. You don't have to be all the way at Addison's. Alcoholism and heavy drug use that causes something called rhabdomyolysis, which is a breakdown of muscle fibers leading to the release of potassium into the bloodstream. That has nothing to do with bringing in. It has more to do with this buildup of the rhabdomyolysis, which breaks down and releases the potassium into the bloodstream. Other things that can cause high potassium is angiotensin converting enzyme, ACE inhibitors, and you've heard of ACE inhibitors with regard to inflammatory conditions. Angiotensin II receptor blockers, ARBs, beta blockers, destruction of red blood cells, excessive potassium supplementation, and type 1 diabetes. A lot of food sources of potassium, right? But look at them. A lot of them are those higher glycemic foods. So I would task you with looking at potassium and looking at how you would get an adequate amount of this nutrient. So look, there's a lot of fruit on here. Apricots, papaya, bananas, cantaloupe, watermelon. And we've got avocados, leafy greens, mushrooms, potatoes, another high glycemic, lima beans, another high glycemic, molasses, another high glycemic. I thought this was a cute picture, so I put it in. This is high potassium foods. So you've got a lot of color there, a lot of color. So let's take a look at a few of the potassium-rich foods, and then WH Foods. WH Foods has some really good charts. There are some herbs, and herbs are really great if you can get herbal sources of some of the nutrients. It makes it easier than having to take supplements. You just sprinkle these herbs on luxuriously. Catnip, hops, horsetail, nettle, plantain, red clover, sage, skullcap, garlic. All of them are fairly easy to get. I think the catnip might be a little bit more difficult. So let's take a look at depleters, potassium depleters. Well, if the kidney's not working properly, all bets are off. It's going to affect the way that the potassium is retained and excreted. Diarrhea. We talked about that already. Tobacco. Tobacco gets in and introduces free radical damage and creates havoc for the user. Caffeine. Alcohol. Large amounts of licorice. The secretion of stress hormones. So the cortisol causes a decrease in the potassium to sodium ratio on the inside and the outside of the cells. So some of the medications that deplete potassium, this is the classes of medications, anti-inflammatory antibiotics, antacids, diuretics, gout medication, and laxatives. So what other medications are linked to hyperkalemia? Potassium-sparing agents, like potassium-sparing diuretics, angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors, ACE inhibitors, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, those are your over-the-counter stuff, anti-infective agents, anticoagulant, cardiac glycoside, and the angiotensin II blockers, the receptor blockers. Those are all having an effect. So let's take a look at how you would assess potassium. The serum level should be between 4.0 and 4.5. So you know how in a lot of the vitamins and some of the minerals, it's really hard to assess the status in serum. Well, of the electrolytes, the sodium, potassium, and the chloride, those are all accurate in the blood. So in other words, it's not like it's most of it's trapped intracellularly or whatever. You're going to get a good reading by doing the serum. But you've got to make sure they're in ideal range, not the range the lab says, because they're very wide ranges and people could be on their way to very bad illness if you don't catch it. So the serum level of potassium, I like to see between 4 and 4.5. You always want to compare it to the sodium and the chloride. Diet diary is a good thing to do because that way you get a sense of, do they have enough potassium-forming foods? Do they have any depleting foods in there? And then, of course, questionnaires and doing a good history, looking at signs and symptoms, and ask them about that. Always ask them about that. How are your cramps? Do you get any muscle cramps? Do you get any of the symptoms that would be related? So when you're supplementing with potassium, you're going to have a lot of choices. You're going to have choices amongst the compound, the type based on compound, whether it's potassium acetate, bicarbonate, citrate, chloride, or gluconate. I haven't seen much in the way of studies to say which one of those is better than one or the other. I'd have to do some more extensive research. Citrate is a very common one that's used. But there's also the modes of administration. I don't like tablets because they tend to not break apart real well, especially if someone has a compromised digestive tract. Capsules are okay for some people. Effervescent tablets could be good because they dissolve when you put them in water. You just want to watch for excipients and additives. Powders are often good. I like powders of the nutrients, and I like liquids, especially when we're looking at ions like this. When we're looking at electrolytes, if you can get an ionic liquid, it's going to get absorbed so much better. It's going to bypass a lot of those intestinal absorption issues that you'll have if you're doing it as a capsule. And that's it. So we have our references. There's a few studies there. The Linus Pauling Institute always has some good stuff. And then there's a article about drugs that deplete. And then there's a Mayo Clinic that's relating type 1 diabetes with potassium. So thank you for being here and for your attention. And I'll see you on the next mineral.